Welcome to this special program recorded in September of 2012 at Waterfall Arts in Belfast as part of the ongoing art exhibit of works by Robert Shetterly, Alan McGee, and Harlan Crichton entitled War on Peace. The program we'll hear today is a conversation about social protest, social change, and the role of art among Robert Shetterly, Alan McGee, and the audience. The moderator for this conversation is Martha Piskuskas, Executive Director at Waterfall Arts. The first voice you'll hear after Martha's is Alan McGee's. The second is that of Rob Shetterly.
Why don't we start off with each of you sharing briefly your artistic journey to this point where you're making this work? Was there a key motivator, an event that led you to shift into more political or message work, if not all the time, at least some of the time?
First, thank you very much. I want to thank everybody at Waterfall Arts, Tammy, Alan, Lorna, Martha. This show wouldn't have been put up just anywhere. It's really, for both of us, I think, a privilege to be able to show this work and to have Waterfall kind of sign their name to it, to be a partner and to be along with us in this expression. For me, I'm often asked, how is it that you started this work? Was it a sudden change? It really wasn't that at all. When I started painting and drawing, I was just a little kid, 2 or 3 years old, and for me, drawing was always a narrative undertaking. I would draw things that related to events on the playground, what other kids were doing, and it was probably many years later that I even realized that pictures were primarily displayed on a wall. They were just something that you made at a desk. So as things transpired, I did end up illustrating for a number of years, and that work, too, was topical. It had to do either with portraits of people that were in the news or something going on in the society. It really wasn't until I began to show in galleries that the work that's better known of mine, the contemplative pieces like the stones, were seen, and that's when I began to do that. So the work that you see here is really, for me, more of a return to something that's instinctive. It's natural for me to respond to issues in society, particularly things that reach, I think, a boiling point, a point when you need to comment. The second part of that question might be what is the catalyst? What make us, either of us, think the way we do? And I think both of us are probably products of the 60s, of the Vietnam era. Whatever became of it, whatever course any young men of our age took, we did have to think about it. It was absolutely necessary. Either we were going to comply with it and say the people who are telling us this is an important and a good war are either right or they know more than we do, or we have to find out what's wrong with that argument. And I think so many young people did do that. We went to whatever sources we could find. Who are the Vietnamese people? What's this all about? Who's Ho Chi Minh? And I think that instinct or that habit has stayed with me. And this work reemerged for me in the 1970s when I think the disappointments over American involvement in Central America got to the point when I just couldn't pretend that it wasn't on my mind anymore. Now, I just wanted to say also, Rob, as you begin talking about this background for you, when I saw what Rob was doing, and we were both, I think this was sort of percolating for both of us at the same time, I felt that what Rob had come onto with this portrait series was the perfect solution, the perfect concept, because it's absolutely true, it's absolutely positive, aside from the physical, beautiful qualities of the paintings, the vividness and humanity in the portraits, the concept of being able to teach history, an unknown part of history through pictures, is just brilliant. And I'm so happy that we can do this together.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Yeah. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for saying that. I mean, it's kind of funny because for years I've idolized this guy. So I really appreciate what you just said. Some of you probably do remember either the Main Times drawings I did or the more surrealistic work that often had embedded in it environmental or political issues. A lot of that work was full of other kinds of narratives, plus psychological, spiritual issues, and it, a lot of the political content was kind of cynical, especially the Maine Times drawings, which is often the character of the drawings that are in newspapers, because you're supposed to, you know, react quickly, almost understand before you look at it what it's supposed to be saying, and say, oh yeah, and then be able to turn the page or start a fire with it. And I often tried to draw something that was pushed people to think a little bit more and about some of these things, but they still had some of that content to them, or that tone. You know, right after 9/11, when the dialogue from our government began to promote the Iraq War, and I don't think there's anything that you could say except that all of our supposed democratic institutions failed, in the sense that, you know, if we really had a free press, it would have exposed that we were being lied to. And there didn't seem to be any strong voice in this country, public voice, that was confronting what was going on. And I was feeling, as an artist, as just as a citizen, you know, more and more isolated from this country and from myself. And the work I had been doing up to that time, that I thought was my obligation as an artist, that kind of surreal, mysterious work with all its ambiguities, no longer seemed right at all. It seemed to exist in a time which wasn't appropriate for it. That I had to, if I was going to be have a voice at this moment, I had to try to talk about the things that were disturbing me the most. And, you know, I was full of anger, I was full of grief about the coming victims of these wars, and I was full of shame for the arrogance of this country. And I thought, you know, how can I, you know, what can you do at this moment that gives you a voice? And it, you know, I worked on a lot of things for several months, most of them just baffling to me, because my first instincts were to act with the kind of art I had done previously, which I knew would not start a conversation, would not get me any sort of public voice. Finally, I actually just looked at my own studio wall, and there was a quote pinned up on the wall years and years earlier from Walt Whitman about how to live in the world. You know, this is what you shall do: love the earth, the sun, and the animals. On and on. And I thought, wow, you know, if I just paint his portrait and scratch those words into it, I will feel better. And that's that's really where this started. It was about making myself feel better. And all the things that have sort of come afterwards have been sort of unintended consequences, in a sense. I mean, I knew that what I would have to do, and I think this has a lot to do with the viability of political art, is how positive it can be. You know, angry art, cynical art, does sing to the choir to a certain extent, and one needs, if you're going to really affect a larger audience at all, it has to be in some way positive enough that many people can appreciate it, look at it, understand it, want to talk about it, feel that it isn't just, you know, one interest group talking, that it includes other people. Let me just go back to the idea of shame. I think a lot of this came out of that sense that I was feeling ashamed. I don't like feeling that way. I thought, well, if I start surrounding myself with people I love and admire, I will feel better. And, you know, to encompass that kind of group of people and those ideas, and I mean, this, you know, most of these are relatively contemporary people, but, you know, I began with all these 19th century figures who all of us at least say we embrace: Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony, you know, Lincoln, all those kinds of people. And so it seemed open. It brought lots of people in, which enabled me to then introduce some of these other people who are a lot more problematic, especially because they're modern and they're courageous and aggressive in their approach to issues today. But I think that was the key, and I think is one of the real keys of political art, is how open it can be. You know, we make a lot of art, and I have too, that is more like a shout. It's a placard. It demands something, and it and the craft in it isn't necessarily strong. But when you make art that is open to lots of people and includes their issues and their history as well as your own viewpoints, it becomes a lot different. And then when you spend, you know, like Alan does, this incredible amount of time making, you know, crafting these images, they then carry a kind of authenticity that some other political art doesn't, I think.
I really want to agree with this idea of sometimes departing from what seemed a kind of a gentle, reasonable, contemplative use of art to something that's more direct. It really can result in you feeling like you've just steered your course to the right place, and you may end up doing work which is other people might find disturbing, and yet there's a certain peace that as a maker you feel when you've adjusted your life and activity to what's going on in your inner life. When you aren't doing that, you might be producing lovely things that everybody will celebrate, but if it's off base, you aren't going to, as you say, you'll feel irresponsible in a certain way.
Yeah.
So did you start feeling more true to your own, going back to your roots of telling your intuitive stories with this kind of work that's here?
I think, it was so natural to, because in a certain way I never lost touch with this kind of using the human face to condense whole scenarios of human behavior, human understanding, because if I'm left alone with a table and a pen and some post-it notes, I start to draw faces. So when this started, it was maybe a more public extension of something that was happening anyway. But it was bound to, I think for me, it was bound to happen because just as Rob said, you recognize, no matter what you're doing as an artist, if that vehicle isn't able to carry the new message, the vehicle has to change, the means have to change. And, you know, maybe we would just have had to start working with clay if we were painters, or just start making things out of sticks, but something has to change so the new way will carry that that new set of ideas.
I want to just pick up briefly on something that Alan said. I mean, about obligations. I think one of the things that this made me think a lot about, I've thought about it before, but I don't think I'd ever thought about it as much until I started doing these portraits, is what our obligations are as artists. You know, so many, whatever profession you are, you're a plumber, an electrician, a doctor, a lawyer, a school teacher, it comes with a set of obligations to society. And they're not always honored, but they're inherent or implicit in the work. I think artists don't necessarily feel that or aren't taught that. We're taught about self-expression, we're taught about craft, we're taught about maybe making something beautiful or making something new, whatever that might be, but we're not necessarily taught about how we are in some sense responsible as artists to something important in our society. This work, I mean, first I was feeling as an artist that I needed to be more responsible. I needed to use what I do best and what Alan does best, you know, to express that feeling, that find that voice. And so this work then became all about responsibility. What is our obligation? How can we fulfill it? And then keep pushing it until we feel that we're having some effect. And I think that's kind of where we both feel very similarly about that.
So taking on this responsibility and doing this kind of work, I want to know what the impact has been. Maybe each of you could talk about that when you bring out this kind of work. What's been the response? Have you had the same kind of interest from the same places? Have different audiences emerged? You know, what's been the result?
We learn as we go. First, as a maker of anything, as a writer, a choreographer, you do your work and you put it into the world, which is the fulfillment of that attempt to express yourself, oneself. Then you observe innocently, you know, what the response is going to be. I think it's no use pretending, from my point of view, that showing work which was quite different from my stones was universally appreciated. It wasn't even uncommon that people, I can't blame them for thinking this, that it may be just a kind of personal upsetness within myself that caused these images. I don't think that's true, and I know we've both discussed this, this is certainly not where it comes from. But I think what happens is, and you don't expect an audience to follow you immediately. Part of our role is that we walk off into a place where other people aren't, at least in regard to what they might think about us, and invite them without cynicism or without anything intentionally harsh, invite them to come along. The ones who come along are the beginnings of a new audience or a new group of people that we can talk to. I don't think it's possible to argue in words the case for any artist for a change in the work. You simply do the work and hope that stepping out on that limb, there'll be somebody else out there already or would like to come with you. So I think it's a mistake to think that for any young person, I think we've talked to a number of young artists about work that's overtly political, it's going to be harder to show. And will people say, no, I don't think we want to show this work, we'd prefer to censor you? Nobody will ever say that. What they'll say is, well, this isn't what we're used to, what we expect, this isn't really, and you'll be kind of left to wonder that this difficulty is a result of the quality of the work because nobody is out there to tell you that. I'm kind of speaking as I would speak to other artists right now, that if you do something that's not universally appreciated, I guess it's my nature to take to heart the response. But I felt strongly about this, and what the result has been that I do feel there's a new audience or a different audience of people that appreciate and respond to work of this kind.
So at first, you thought people were responding thinking that you were personally troubled. Is that what you were saying?
It happened, and I think it's not an unusual response. Now, maybe it's something to do with the visual arts. Rob said something that might have bearing on this. Artists are either subliminally or overtly trained in certain ways to behave. I think one of those is that you develop a kind of signature style that somebody can see what you've done. They don't sort of hit you if you don't do this in art school, but the general drift is you're going to be doing something through your life that's going to, if you're chuck clothes, they're going to be big heads. Whatever else. And, you know, when you do something else, particularly if even thematically or viscerally it's different, it's kind of a surprise. I'm not saying this was even common, but it surprised me that I even had to answer the question or address the idea that work that was in response to glaring social injustices would be, just simply coming from a personal wellspring. It's not that. You're responding to something you can't bear any longer.
Do you think that your past success has allowed you to show this work? I know it's hard to conjecture, but that might not have the same breadth of audience, I guess.
It's kind of a difficult question. I don't know, but I think if we're going to behave badly, we should start young. Because if you surprise people later on, you're not going to get any credits for years of good behavior. So I don't know. I can't say. My brother is a psychologist, and he has a concept called eccentricity credits. You know what those are? Eccentricity credits are when you've behaved so well that a single eccentricity will be forgiven. But I don't think in practice it works like that. You need to clear this ground right away when you're about 4 years old. This is what I'm going to do. Get used to it. So I don't think it. I mean, who knows if it was a help? I think what I noticed was the surprise when you try to clear a little bit of new ground. It requires patience and effort and a certain openness towards people who don't understand. No one's trying to be hostile. They simply don't get it.
Yeah, curiously, one of the big obstacles in showing work like this is not people. It's the art world. I mean, when you talk about some of the deep emotions that are in these things, I mean, you look at these images of these faces here, and the compassion, the anger, the pity, deep sense of wonder at what happened to here, and why what is really going on? Why have we done this? How does one survive this kind of thing? Those feelings, surprisingly, are not thought to be particularly commercial. And not every gallery wants to hang them. And I think what happened to me was, and Gail and I have talked about this a lot. I mean, painted the first portrait, I said, you know, I'm going to make 50 of these portraits. I'm going to call them Americans to Tell the Truth, and then I'm going to give them away. I'm not going to sell these paintings. And for me, there was this moment of just almost like levitation. I thought, wow, I can now say, I mean, as artists, we feel, like to feel anyway, that we're a little bit freer, perhaps, than some other people. We do say what we want to say, but there's also a market, and we do depend on selling pictures. And I thought, wow, if I'm not going to sell these paintings, I don't have to worry about that at all. And that was so freeing. And then I could go about, you know, picking people I thought were some of the toughest truth tellers with some of the toughest truths they have to tell and put them out there. I didn't get pushback from galleries because I wasn't trying to sell it. What I did get pushback was from social critics. I mean, Alan Dershowitz, who said, when he saw this book and he reviewed it, he said, this is the literary equivalent of child abuse. He said, this book would give a smile to old Joe Stalin.
Yeah.
I mean, really?
That was a compliment, though.
Rosa Parks, yeah. Martin Luther King, Margaret Chase Smith, what are we talking about here? How did you step into that arena of going beyond what is normally accepted as conversation in the art world about beauty and composition and color and ways of presenting things, you attract all kinds of other people who feel that you have invaded their territory and want to actually influence policy. And when you start to do that, a lot of people feel as an artist, you've gone way too far. And Alan and I think, feel that, you know, we have an obligation to go there as people who are not, you know, controlled by other interest groups. We can say what we really believe and hope that it has some effect.
Can you talk a little bit more about, I don't know if everyone here knows about the success of the Americans Who Tell the Truth series. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that. And for instance, right now, where are your portraits?
Because there's so many of them, they can be in lots of places at one time. I've never seen them all together, and I don't think I ever will. And so there's a very large show opened the last week of August at the Muhammad Ali Center in Louisville called Muhammad Ali and the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, the whole city came out for the opening. The mayor opened the show. It was really extraordinary. A lot of people in that show were, including a recent portrait of a woman named Ann Braden, which was unveiled in the rotunda of the city capitol the day before the opening at the Ali Center, you know, used to be, was demonized in Louisville in the 1950s and 60s because she was one of the most important and courageous white civil rights workers in the whole country. She was charged with sedition in the 50s, and her husband was put in jail for sedition, for helping a black person buy a house in a white neighborhood. 17 years for that. There's that show. There's a show in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I'm going next week at the University of Cincinnati. There's another show at the Miami University. It travels constantly to lots of places and has had an extraordinary effect, certainly on my life, and hopefully on a few other lives, especially young people. I mean, to me, this is the importance of it now is all about education, and particularly education about citizenship. I mean, there's a lot of history, but to me, the history is a means of teaching role models for how all of us need to act as citizens in a country if we expect the country to do the things that are good for the common good, for the environment, for all of us as citizens of a democracy. And to me, these are models of how you confront those problems and how you confront the interests that would keep that from happening. You know, a country acting for the common good. It's kind of remarkable. I mean, the legs it has.
So I'm just going to stop for a second and see if there's any questions that are arising. I see one over there.
I have a question that has a sort of historical trajectory. As visual artists in this day, you have a very different context in which to put your work out I'm reading the McCullough book about the young painters who went to Paris in the 1830s, 40s, because that's the only place I could see old masters. And I think of the three generations of the Wyatts, NC Illustrated Books, which was the most familiar way ordinary citizens encountered an image, or the Saturday Evening Post, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Andrew lives in a world when movies come in, television comes in, and now Jamie's got a world where internet's there, a torrent of images. How do you work in that world to be effective or to be able to get your things made visible and gather that audience, new or old, as you've described it?
The internet is a very important thing to me. I mean, there's a website that has all the portraits on it. It has a curriculum for how to teach around these for all different ages. I mean, I write essays for it. It has student and teacher responses from all over the place. It has a lot of stuff on it, and that's how word about this show actually gets out there. I don't depend on the major media at all because they ignore this, as they ignore your work probably.
What about the art world? Do you depend on the art world in any way for this work?
Maybe somewhat. I mean, I don't know. There are parts of the art world who certainly respond to this, in particular other artists. I mean, when I go to say a college to talk, which I do frequently, I mean, I'm in the history department, I'm in the ethics department, I'm in the religion department. I sometimes give a talk in the art department or a workshop, but it's not necessarily the first place that responds to this.
Does that bother you, that the art departments aren't the ones who are clamoring for you to come and talk about the work?
No, it doesn't bother me because the mission with this is not necessarily to get to artists or teach techniques. It's to get to anybody who will listen and to teach citizenship. It's a means. I mean, it really is a means. And although I hope to inspire other people to do whatever they can do to use their voice through art to raise consciousness in this country and in the world about how to engage issues.
But that's where I think that what you said earlier about artists have a responsibility, and this seems to me to be a great opportunity for you to share that with artists as you travel
around. Oh, I certainly do.
Yeah.
I do say that. You know, I preach a lot at young artists.
Do you want to answer
Well,
the question?
I think I was just thinking about there are all these opportunities. There are so many ways to get work into the world. Just one artist has been kind of an inspiration to me on one of the ways to work without asking anything of this world of museums and galleries. The artist is named Klaus Steck, and he lives in Heidelberg. And for 30 years, I think it was at least that long ago, I saw some of the first pictures of his. He's covered and made public posters on every variety of social issue, environmental issue, hunger. He works in partnership with a silk screener in Heidelberg. Steck is a lawyer by training and I guess got into activism, and then you could call it political art. I don't know what it is, but now he has a great following, I guess like you do, Rob, that people, these works were never made for sale. They were made to get posted, and I guess Steck was making a living as a lawyer in part. But now this work is widely sought after, and there are hundreds of images, and you can look on his website. He's also a person that's been very helpful to younger artists, and it is one of the ways, you know, it's still an antiquated means of printmaking, but it is a way of getting images out where you don't, you're not going the route of the art museum. Both you and I were asked to write a section of a book by Chris Hedges called Death of the Liberal Class, and the question was, are the avenues of the art world, for better or worse, whatever they do well, are they any good at, can we look to them to help us, inform us or encourage us for commenting on society? And I think we both felt there are big problems. It looks as if everything is fine until you actually want to push into one of these areas. It's not so compatible. And you wouldn't know this until you look into it or live that life for a few years. You had a take on it that a lot of it is the way there's great art of all kinds being produced. There's a small portion of it that's being widely publicized through art journals, through the choices made by museums, and most of it doesn't have much to do with society or war, you know, any aspect of the things we're dealing with.
I'd like to speak to this piece right here. And it somehow seems to me to be prophetic, almost, that we're talking about, thinking about the consequences of our silence. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could comment on
that. I'll tell you a little bit, because I haven't said much about the origin of the pieces, the works of mine here. In 88, I really started this group work in 1984. It went through several phases. Most of it was accusatory and somewhat angry. There were things that could be made in the 80s that could be used for kind of an Occupy Wall Street idea today. But just before the so-called Gulf War, the summer of 1990, we could see these events going to happen. And we kind of also had a sense that no amount of protest, these were decisions that were not really subject to what this population felt. And one of the foregone decisions made by the government was learning the lessons of Vietnam. No images of suffering, death, injury are going to be shown on television. Now, we're really into the sophisticated clamp down on that today. But in the summer of 1990, anticipating that this war would happen soon, I had a show lined up at George Stempfli's gallery in New York. It was probably, the anticipation was there were going to be a show of realist paintings. And I started these. I don't know if they're monotypes, just made on metal plates. I rub out the face with a paper towel, really out of ink. These pictures came of kind of an anticipation of all of this suffering that's going to be hidden, absolutely not shown. Therefore, no sympathy can be generated. We hear the reasons why the war is so heroic and wonderful and necessary. The curb to that in a population is that they get to glimpse a little bit of what's happening on the suffering end. We were going to be completely shut out of that. Now, I didn't do these pictures as illustrations of specific suffering. They were just a kind of spontaneous response to knowing that. And the picture silence just seemed to... It was done sometime during that summer. This is a tapestry made from a monotype about this size. And I guess the thought was, well, we're never going to hear from these people. There may be interviews and small out-of-the-way publications, or we can dig and find. We're just not going to be shown all of this stuff except maybe remote images of things exploding and how wonderful. So that's where those came from. This picture is called Silence.
Comment, though. To me, this talks about the personal consequences mm-hmm. of our silence.
That's a good response. I mean, I want these to be open-ended, and perhaps even a title sometimes can be too much. Something like this happens, the anguish and repercussions go in all directions. Certainly, we can't take part in something like this, no matter how comfortable we may feel. We can't come out of it unscathed, and I don't simply mean retaliation to terrorist responses. I don't mean blowback. I just don't think a culture can be blind and silent and at the same time healthy.
I'm sure you all know, but in regard to that kind of silence and the suppression of images of what actually happens in war, you know, in the middle of the back wall is Bradley Manning. And, you know, he's in jail now, charged with treason and espionage because he released images of Americans shooting civilians from a helicopter. You know, that's how far we've come from a time when, you know, as you mentioned, the Vietnam War, when actually images not unlike that were actually shown on primetime TV. And the military establishment and political establishment realized what a big mistake that was, you know, because it allowed citizens of the country to actually see how policies played out, what the cost was. And so it's been quite a journey, but I think it's, you know, it's very important that we are aware of Bradley Manning and also aware of what kind of suffering exists, and Alan's work, you know, helps to, you know, portray that.
Alan, can you talk about the response at the time when you had these images in that show?
Well, it was an interesting time. The show was opened in December of 1990, and if you remember, the beginning of the bombing in this Gulf War started, the show was either still up or coming near its end at the time when the bombing started. And nobody knew quite when it was, but it was at the bombing began in January 1991. So the show went up at Stemfli's Gallery in Soho. George Stemfli, as an aside, was a wonderful art dealer, a Swiss artist who came here and started a gallery. He was educated in German literature and art history, had a PhD from European universities in both subjects, and was unusually aware of the range of what art and literature historically could do. I mean, he wasn't just a picture salesman. When I told him I was going to be doing this work, he said, well, I sent him some pictures. He said, keep on going, we'll show them. Now that, I had no idea that doesn't just happen every day. But the show brought a large group of people in. New York was very quiet. I think there was this anticipation that something was about to happen, the war was going to break out. But remarkably, there were a lot of pictures sold from that show. So I think it tapped into something. One person bought a group of six of them, of six large ones, and then a lot of the little ones. So I think one of the things that might be important to say is we have this art establishment that thinks it knows what people want, knows what they were going to buy. If you can circumvent that and go directly to people, what people are able to respond to is quite different from this narrow funnel that everything is supposed to be forced through, you know, through this art world. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it except when it closes down possibilities. I think that what we're being shown through this mainstream is so much less than people can really grasp. So that the response was pretty good. I'd say it was quite good. And as always, when I do put this work up, whatever, you know, might pass for success of a show, there's a lot of talk. And people want to ask and think about it. So that for me is a lot.
Checking in on other questions from the audience.
Parts of the country.
The show has been in, I think, more than 26 states now. Some of them repeatedly, and also the Washington, D.C. a couple of times. But it's it hasn't been in the South much. It's been once in Florida at a school. It was at a prep school in Jacksonville, and then it's been in Texas, but it was in Austin, so that doesn't count either. So... other than that, well, actually, there was a group of women portraits in Tennessee and another group at an educational conference in San Antonio. But generally, it doesn't go much below the Mason-Dixon line. But Louisville's a big exception. It's been there a lot. But anyway, that's yes. The answer is the short answer is yes. There are areas, and a lot of times you don't even think about where it's. You know, even within a particular state, say if it's in New York, where is it not going in New York, and who's not seeing it? You know, and that's probably follows the same kind of demographic in a way. It's interesting. You had a question right there.
Say more about is this a policy or a law that the news isn't showing us portraits of what's going on? I it's sort of gone by me. I see it's true, but I hadn't even given it any thought.
I've read a lot about what people in the political establishment and the military establishment had to say about the pushback that came in Vietnam, you know, from people in the country when they saw all this firsthand news, and what effect that had on, you know, morale. And so, there were a lot of decisions made then to try to control the news. Broadly speaking, you know, it's probably impossible to maintain any semblance of democracy without a truly free press. We don't have that. I mean, we do have it in, you know, Democracy Now! And some websites on the internet, but our major media is corporate-owned and basically does what their corporate sponsors or the government or the military want it to do. That controls the message and makes democratic discussion about issues impossible. It also controls the kind of images we see. So I think it's a very intentional set of decisions. Certainly not a law. I mean, they'd be aghast if you said there was a law.
But they know they can't do it.
Just like there was no law that said you can't show images of caskets coming back from Iraq in the first weeks and years of that war.
Yes, there was.
Was it a law? But what was the law exactly?
Act of Congress.
Oh, really? Well, see, I was wrong about that.
In the theory that it dishonors the dead to see the coffins
vibrate. Yeah, that's wrong. So that's interesting.
Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. What's your feeling about this artist named Steve Mumford, who is known as he was embedded in Iraq and done a lot of really careful representations of soldiers behind the lines and stuff. I just wonder what you're feeling, either or both of you. What your feeling is about that?
Well, you probably know. I had some engagement with Steve Mumford. I wrote a review of his show. I think he's a very talented artist. I mean, I went and saw his show at the CMCA, and what I said about it and what I would maintain was that the guy's really talented. And that the problem with his show wasn't his work, it was the way it was promoted, I thought. That this was promoted as an embedded artist who was, in a sense, telling the truth about war. It told a very narrow picture that was only from the U.S. point of view. I mean, it didn't show, just like we were saying, it showed no victims. There were no victims except American soldiers who had lost limbs. Those were the victims. There were no Iraqi victims. And that's what I engaged about that. You know, if you're going to promote a show as telling the truth about war, tell the truth. You know, show everybody what actually happens. I mean, the American soldiers, of course, need, they're real people. They deserve their humanity honored. And that's what he did, is honor their humanity. But he didn't honor the humanity of the other side. And how can you tell the truth about a war if you don't do that?
I think one problem, and you'd remember that the show, I think even as you walk in, what you ended up being reading or being told was that the show was completely unbiased and neutral and objective, and neither of us felt that was the way we were reading it at all.
You spoke earlier about a free press and an independent press, and I was looking at the paintings of Daniel Ellsberg, who released the Pentagon Papers and basically brought down the president. And the New York Times asserted its independence and against the threats and all kinds of things that it was, all kinds of penalties that it was being, you know, was being threatened with, went ahead and published the Pentagon Papers and made history, and comparing that with Bradley Manning. And we have a free press, we have an independent press. I wonder if you could speak to the question of whether or not we still have an adversarial press and how important that is.
Well, I read an article a few years ago that said some editors at the New York Times were asked if they would print something like the Pentagon Papers today, and the answer was no.
Did they say why?
Well, I think it was implied, but I'm not sure that they actually said why. I think it has a lot to do with ownership. There was some articles just recently about some of the articles they were running, and I forget the exact issue now, but basically, you know, they were working hand in glove with people in Pentagon and in the State Department, getting information from them. And in order to not endanger those relationships, they were going to say what those people wanted said. And it was just like, you know, at the run-up to the Iraq War, you know, there was a couple of moments there when probably the New York Times could have stopped the war. And instead, they printed Judith Miller's article, which was fed to them, was fed to her by Cheney's people, and then Cheney pointed to it and said, look what the New York Times said, this must be true about the aluminum tubes and all that business which was made up. They enabled it. And if that's what you mean by an adversarial press, we don't have it. You know, there's adversarial about personal issues, about sex lives of our politicians and stuff, and, you know, where they ask tough questions, you know, but about big policy issues that are actually important to the maintenance of a democracy, or whether we have war or not, or whether we do something about climate change, it's pretty rare.
Just one thing that, you know, I don't know if any one person's able to answer this question thoroughly enough, unless they're in that world, but our friend Chris Hedges, in the book Death of the Liberal Class, talks about his own experiences at the New York Times and a number of fellow journalists who at the beginning of the Iraq invasion were outspoken about it and were told to put a lid on it, you know, or resign. And of course, a lot of his books about war have come after that episode. And in the book, he talks about not only his own experiences, but interviews other people that during that time, I can remember one colleague of his saying, it made me feel sick every time I went through that revolving door at the Times, feeling the restrictions that are on me now to come out with the way I'm seeing this. So there are problems, and that book is a good place to get an overview from somebody that's in that world.
Given the censorship that exists, and a little parenthesis in that is, I think I speak for everyone here, are extremely grateful for WERU and the programming that they have and how they inform this community in a way that I've not experienced anywhere else. And given the censorship that exists broadly, and given the spin that exists, Fox News, for example, how much hope, or I guess that's not how I want to say it, what suggestions might you have for people, for us, to be able to really begin to make, to erode some of these policies and lies that are around us, so entrenched?
You know, that's, you almost said the word hope. you look at the nature and the size of some of the systemic problems that are there, and it's daunting, very daunting. And I think, though, that a lot of our activities are best focused locally. This place right here, Waterfall Arts, is a great center both of, I'm sure, art and conversation and organizing for this community and the larger community around all kinds of local issues. We are all so embedded personally. That's one of the problems with confronting some of these issues is our society has made us all so complicit in all the things which we rail against. And it makes it very hard for us to confront them. This plastic bottle right there, you could use that as an example and talk for a long time about what that means in terms of economy and pollution and everything else, energy. But what I'm going to say is just that focus on local systems and maybe particularly, the one thing we are beginning to do a whole lot about and can have a huge effect is, around food. That's one of the great places to start, both with organizing and educating and then acting to change the way we are involved with the larger food system and all the ways that involves every other system. Transportation would be a harder one, Housing, maybe not so much. We can begin to do something about that. But I think as we all, as communities, rearrange and take control of our own lives locally, it will give us both models to transport and to for other communities, and also a great deal of strength to begin to feel some kinds of hope in regard to how we can affect the larger world.
Probably I'm reaching people on a smaller scale, or at least at a rate a little different than you, but I'm always encouraged when someone is encouraged by what I do. I'm always thinking, well, that must be what it really is comes down to. I don't have a lot of hope, for example, that political art changes very much. I think it might encourage people in ways that maybe could have an effect. But within any range of, you mentioned food, within this enormous range of interconnected problems, probably every person feels a very single aptitude where one aspect of this becomes very interesting or very much within reach, that the whole thing is so daunting that you really just want a good glass of whiskey and let's just forget the whole thing. But, for example, Monica, my wife, has since about 1990 worked with our three towns on recycling, and she really understands it now and is, deeply interested in the complicated set of problems that you take on trying to get the trash handled in a responsible way. It's a little aspect. All these things fit together, but they're all tied together. And you pull the string on one spot, it all moves.
I'd like to just say that both of you are sort of examples of what's possible in terms of taking those feelings of impotence and what do I do, everything is so ominous, and you are artists and you figured out ways to give voice to some of that and as a result are reaching audiences in new ways. I'm sure that each of you have had wonderful interactions with people who come to you and talk about their how they've learned something from your work.
You know, feeling oppressed, feeling overwhelmed, feeling hopeless is extremely alienating and isolating. And as soon as any of us begin at any level in any way to engage with other people, to work on an issue that we can actually affect in some way, everything changes in the way we feel and also the joy with which we live. And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that artists tend to be kind of isolated, you know, working alone and all that kind of thing. But when you do work that engages public issues, it suddenly puts you in a different relationship with your community. And you do get all this feedback. And it is very exciting because you begin to, people, as you say, you know, say, wow, I was moved by that to do something myself. And that that is very satisfying.
So one more question.
I'm beginning to realize that this is so important as sort of an antidote to one of humanity's tendencies after war, which is triumphalism. I think we need this sense of something that draws out empathy in us for other human beings. I think if you look at these faces, you listen to these statements, that these are things which we, as just a simple human being, one person to an image, basically, we feel empathy towards their humanity.
Yeah. That's so what you're saying is, I think, when all of these aspects, we get the journalism, or for better or worse, we get you know, all of the political analyses, we don't get really a handle on empathy. I mean, we have to make an effort to understand what's going on and connect to it. There was a psychologist at work with Germans who had taken part in the Holocaust, the Mitscherlichs. There were a couple, Alexander and Margarita. They wrote a book called The Inability to Mourn. What they wrote would be applicable to us. If there's this awful thing that has taken place, you know, you can't just get on to the next thing. You have to take stock of it. And as it turned out, I think this generation seemed generally unable to deal with it, but their children, they really got it. All of the efforts made within Germany to educate kids about the Holocaust, about all aspects of it, German kids know this because you say, walk around Berlin, you can't go a block without seeing a monument or a plaque or a museum. So the children got it, but the participants seemed, it was maybe too hard to face. Maybe they were too embarrassed, too shamed. But the idea was you just can't get on with business as usual after something horrendous like that.
One of the whole reasons for this show, as mentioned sort of earlier, was Tammy's involvement in wanting to bring Paul Chappelle here to speak. And in his books, he speaks, I think, profoundly to this issue. I mean, we all know, I think, that wars would probably not be possible unless there were a way to short-circuit people's empathy, you know, by demonizing, victimizing, dehumanizing, objectivizing other people, making them less than human. You know, if you use enough fear and, as you put it, triumphalism or exceptionalism, whatever it is, and combine those two things, it enables us to start killing people. The struggle against that is a struggle for all of us, our prey to those feelings at times. And I left out racism, that's a big part of it. As we struggle against those, the other part of it, of course, is the press again. You know, if the press goes along with that kind of demonizing of other people and objectivizing of them, you know, you know, you don't feel like you have to feel any empathy. And you shouldn't, you know, because they're somebody who's a threat to you and needs to be removed. But that's the key, probably, to this whole thing and to so many other social issues. It's not just war.
All right, well, I guess we'll end there. And thank you so much for coming. And I encourage you to keep talking.
We've been listening to a conversation on social protest, social change, and the role of art among Robert Shetterly, Alan McGee, and the audience, recorded at Waterfall Arts in Belfast, September of 2012. The moderator was Martha Piskuskas of Waterfall Arts. This event was one of several that are part of the War on Peace exhibit. On October 18th, photographer Alan Crichton, whose images are also part of the exhibit, will give an artist talk on his work. On October 26th, Captain Paul Chappell will give a talk on Waging Peace. On November 3rd, there will be an interactive performance entitled Jump. And on Veterans Day, November 12th, an all-day draw-a-thon with local artists entitled Bring Our War Dollars Home. All events will take place at Waterfall Arts in Belfast. For specific times and other information, go to www.waterfallarts.org. If you missed any of today's program or would like to hear it again, it will be available in the WERU archives at www.weru.org. I'm Jim Campbell. Thanks for listening.